Hello and welcome to The Progress Theory, where we discuss scientific principles for optimizing human performance. I am Dr. Phil Price, and on today's episode, we are joined by UK elite CrossFit athlete, David Shirunke. Now, I've followed David on social media for quite some time, and it's just been amazing to see him rise through the ranks and become one of the best CrossFit athletes in the UK and in Europe. And he did this while being one of the taller athletes. So what I wanted to find out was more around his training philosophy and how he makes programming decisions, any recommendations for the taller athletes, and what is his opinion when it comes to the difference between a hybrid athlete and a CrossFit athlete. As always, follow The Progress Theory on Instagram, YouTube, and check out all of our other content. Here is David Shirunke. Are you a hybrid athlete who wants to learn more about how to combine your strength and endurance training? Well, I've written a new book, The Science of Hybrid Training. In this book, I provide insight into the misconceptions surrounding strength and endurance training by distilling the past 50 years of research and drawing on the conversations I had with great scientists, coaches, and athletes on the Progress Theory podcast. This book is essential reading for hybrid athletes and coaches who are looking to understand the key training variables and their effect on the simultaneous development of strength and endurance performance. Get your copy now, available to buy from Amazon. Now, let's get into the show. David, thank you so much for coming on to The Progress Theory.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, how's training going? I know you've been really busy recently. What's been keeping you for the last, 2 months?
So we had semi-finals not long ago. Europe semi-final was a thing about 2 weeks ago. My season took a sharp turn after quarterfinals because I didn't qualify for semifinals this year, which was a big shock and a big disappointment, obviously, because I feel fitter than I ever have been, especially significantly better than I was this time last year when I not only qualified for semifinals, but also qualified for the games. I suppose the process of determining which athletes go through to semifinals has been a bit different this year. And that just has unfortunately not worked in my favor as someone who struggles with online competition. And so I wasn't able to go to semifinals and express my fitness there and my ability to perform well in person. And so my season looks very different now because that's my CrossFit game season over. And I'm now deciding where I'm going to turn my attention. Is that going to be to other competitions later on in the season that are separate from the CrossFit Games season, other big competitions where I can still compete against some of the best in the world, get some more competition experience, have some fun, and also earn a bit of competition money and the prize money in the process? Do I want to sink into another building phase to get ready for next year? So it's that's where I'm at the moment, just a bit of decision making and picking goals to aim for in the future.
Yeah, I've heard quite a lot around the online sort of qualification process and how that really does seem to favor certain athletes. So I can imagine there's quite a lot of logistical issues to think about when designing the workouts for them. Usually it's around space and that. And that doesn't always seem to, and this is my sort of personal what I see, but doesn't seem to favor taller athletes at all. They're quite selective with what exercises they choose for the WODs, and it doesn't seem to favor taller athletes. Is that quite often the case when it comes to the online qualifiers?
You've touched on part of it there, which is that they are restricted in what movements they can really program for online events because you have to take into consideration the equipment and space that people have in the gyms that they're trying to complete these workouts in. So the workouts tend to lend themselves better to shorter athletes, a bit more range of motion based movements, a lot of burpees and body weight. I don't think that the nature of the tests this year was so extremely biased. I think it was more the unfortunate judging process of the tests. I didn't receive any penalties for any of mine, but I think around at least 50% of the tests were not judged. They were not assessed. So therefore, you don't know how valid those scores are, and therefore you don't know if you are sending the correct people to semifinals because the videos have not been assessed. And that seemed to be, that wasn't just for me, that was for basically across the board in Europe, that workouts 1 and 2 were assessed and workouts 3 and 4 were not. And I think for me, being a taller athlete, those workouts that involved 100 plus or hundreds of reps of body weight movements that were not assessed then means that it leaves far more people above me that potentially shouldn't be above me if their videos had been reviewed. But the thing I always come back to is that the best in the sport always make it through to the next stage. So I could talk more about the judging process is unfair, that it's inconsistent, that it's not professionally done and therefore doesn't lead to the correct people going through to semifinals. But I could focus on that, but then I could also focus on what can I do to be fit enough to qualify through any stage of competition, no matter how bad the judging is, the workout programming is, whatever it is. Because at the end of the day, the best in the sport always make it through. And I would rather focus on that because that's more within my control than bitching about the other stuff.
I can understand that. It certainly is like a mindset towards it, but it must also be quite frustrating because it's also CrossFit's job to make sure that those that have the best fitness or physical qualities, which they deem to be right for the fittest in the world, are the ones to get through. So to have an inconsistent judging system seems a bit like poor on their part, because obviously you're doing your job to try and be as fit as possible to get to the next stage so that whatever test is thrown at you, that you can get to it. But, you know, they've got to provide the platform for that to happen. But that's not something to dwell on.
No, but I agree.
Yeah. So you said that leading up to this semifinals that you were probably the fittest that you've ever been. And then the previous year, you made it to the semifinal. No, you made it for the CrossFit Games. You won an event, et cetera, et cetera. So to improve on that is awesome. What changes did you make to bring you to this up to this next level?
So there were some changes that we made, as in at the beginning of the season, at the end of the season after the CrossFit Games, is a period of coming down, period of time off of training. Don't think about training, think about CrossFit, try and get as far away from it as possible to give yourself some physical restoration, but primarily the mental rest from the sport as well. And then after that, we come back, we make an assessment of the previous year. What went well? What didn't go well? And what can we do to bring the weaknesses up whilst keeping the strengths where they currently are, if we can, or even improving on the strengths a little bit, if we can, because to secure more of those home runs, more of the event wins, which give you a big boost of points and help on the leaderboard. And I think that the big change that we made this season was the structure of the training and the balance of the frequency of different movements, the volume and the intensity of different workouts and movements, so that my training could be more consistent. And by consistent, less disrupted by things like very poor sleep, by injury or niggles. And I think that having more of that training consistency because of a better balance of the week of training is what led to me being able to make more progress than in previous years, where I've had to deal with one or multiple of those things, especially sleep as well.
Is that around programming the week so that you had like certain key sessions, I don't know, in the morning, so you were more fresh for those mornings, and that means you could get all of your training done at a certain point in the day, so you had time to recover, then proper sleep, et cetera, et cetera? Or was it more lifestyle changes which allowed you to hit those qualities that you need, like hydration, sleep, all of those types of things, that allowed you to do that better, which then just provided more of a foundation for the actual programming of the week?
Both in a big way. Lifestyle changes. One of the big things that I struggled with in the 2023 season was sleep. Over the off season, I developed quite bad insomnia, and I'd always struggled with sleep, but it started to get to the point where I was sleeping on average around 5 to 6 hours a night, which for some people who are not doing a very high volume of training, while it's definitely not healthy, is something you can still like function on. But then when trying to do 5 to 6 hours of training a day, it was hell for majority of the off season. And as it got close to competition, it got worse. And over quarterfinals, it would drop down to like, I was sleeping like 3 to 4 hours a night. At semifinals, I think I slept a total of 7 hours across the 3 days of semifinals, and I was absolutely exhausted. And it continued, and it essentially stemmed from stress and anxiety to just worry about the competition, about making sure that I do well, about the pressure that I was putting on myself to perform and improve. And so a big lifestyle change was changing my approach to training and changing my approach to competition so that I can be a bit more satisfied with my daily effort. I can find wins throughout the day. I can go to bed a bit more relaxed and less stressed about my commitments and sleep better, which then, just like it's a downward spiral when the sleep is bad, because you anything could set it off. It could be like noise outside, or I've had a particularly bad day and that stops me from sleeping. But then the knock-on effect is you start getting stressed about the fact that you can't sleep, and that then stops you from sleeping, and then you get that vicious cycle. But it works the other way as well, where if you're sleeping well and you're relaxed, you stop worrying about the things that could stop you from sleeping well, and you start to believe more that, like, I can have a good night's sleep, I can go to bed relaxed, I don't have to have things perfect, it doesn't have to be like the perfect, it doesn't have to be dark, I don't have to step away from the TV an hour before bed. You get yourself into a bit more of a positive cycle as well. And so that's been a big part of this past season, to improve the sleep. Other lifestyle changes have been trying to prioritize or make more time for downtime throughout the day. I think something that I got wrong and have got wrong throughout my career is thinking that the harder I train, the more frequent the stress stimulus on the body, and the more tired I make myself through training, the easier I'm then going to be able to relax and sleep at the end of the day. When what I found is that the opposite is true. And the more you stimulate that sympathetic system when you're training, the harder it is to come back down into the parasympathetic. And so I've tried to make more time to come back down and relax and bring myself back to baseline between sessions and around training, so that when it gets to the evening, I haven't spent my whole day up here and then suddenly have to find a way to come down. I've had periods to come down throughout the day, and so it's easier for my body to come down at the end of the day and relax. Training changes have been more, so it's been both understanding what works for me in terms of frequency of doing different movements, and also applying even more than we had in the past, like a better consolidation of stresses. So I'm having periods of time, like a day of training, where I've got my like heavy knee extension and my bounding and running, and then the next day I can have a complete rest from those movements, and then the next day I can then load them again. And by having that frequency throughout the week, it gives me time to recover, so I'm not hammering my knees like every single day, just a little bit, and then get to the end of the week and I can't recover in time for the next week. So that consolidation of stresses has worked. And then also understanding a bit more the rate at which my body adapts to doing certain movements. So starting off at the beginning of the season with very low volume of certain things, and then waiting for the adaptation to occur before I start adding in more volume. And so it's now got to the point where I can run and jump and squat almost every day if I need to in some format. But that's because we started so small earlier on in the season that I've developed that tolerance. And so that's another big part on the training side.
Now, it's really interesting to hear, especially regarding your ability to recover and how you're really focusing on making sure you have downtime to help with that. I know that CrossFit seems to get, more so from in the boxes, they get a lot of criticism that here's your session, go at it 100%. And then you recover from it. At the elite level, they don't necessarily do that. Even though you've got your hot sessions, you've got your other sessions where you probably, in terms of intensity, you know, fluctuate throughout the week. But people seem to think it's only training that's causing you to be at full intensity. Like if you train hard and then you kind of mentally are staying at that intensity, that's really quite knackering. So if you are like that throughout the day, like you kind of described, and then by the end of the day, you're expected to suddenly drop, and you're like, well, you've just spent the whole day at like this level. It's not as easy just to sort of, you know, tell your body just to calm down. You're going to go into sleep soon. It doesn't really work like that. So what kind of things did you do to try and emphasize that? Did you have a longer period in between double or triple day sessions, or was there particular activities you did between sessions which just helped your mind switch off to allow your body to physically recover as well?
I am one of those people who finds it very difficult to just do nothing. Always, like, if I have spare time, I'm instantly like, okay, what job needs to be done? What work do I have to do? What work could I get ahead on? So it's constantly, from the moment I wake up, it's go, go, go. I think I was raised with the mindset of like, if you're not busy doing something, you're being lazy. And so constantly trying to fill my time with tasks. And there are some tasks that I have to do, like work-wise. There's commitments that I want to fulfill for my sponsors and people that support me to do what I do. There's things outside of training that needs to be done, as well as just like regular life stuff. The biggest thing was appreciating that it doesn't necessarily mean if I'm not doing something throughout the day, at some certain point in the day, and I'm giving myself time to just relax and chill and just watch some nonsense, read a book, do something that allows my mind to just detach itself from training and any other jobs, that's not lazy. In effect, I'm choosing to do that because that's what's best for recovery for my sport. So I should treat that with the same respect that I would treat the training itself, because that's what's going to allow me then to have another good quality training session. So in practice, that just means that I make time within the middle of the day between the sessions where I do nothing, where if I just want to watch some nonsense online, if I want to play PlayStation, if I want to read my book, I do that for an hour and I just allow my brain to switch off. And that has really helped to just bring me back down again to a much more relaxed state, so that when it's time for the next session and when it's time to relax at the end of the day, I've had some time down there already. This is probably like the reason why, you know, athletes get that, they have that stigma around them, that they're like, they train and then they go home, they just put the feet up, play PlayStation all day. And an element of that is true and is necessary, because the best way for you to recover is to bring yourself into that the most relaxed state. And while programming or other work that I have to do online is something that I have to do, it's not the optimal for recovery, because I am still having to focus and mentally, like, I'm not able to switch off while I'm doing that. So making that time in the middle of the day has been a big one.
No, certainly. There's quite a lot of research, especially recently, in terms of they'll have some group cycling. But before they do their cycling effort, they have to do some form of mental task on a laptop, for example. And it's always the ones that did the mental task beforehand then felt like their RPE from that cycling session was much higher than the other group. So doing something mentally taxing before then changes your perception of how hard the session is. And obviously that's going to affect your training. So I think it's really cool that you're not necessarily like, I've got this work to do, but that's not going to emphasize my recovery. So I'm not going to do that at that point, because I need to prioritize my recovery. And I'm putting that in my program. Great to see this change of perception, but also that's just structured training, isn't it? The way you're describing it, I need to recover. These are the things that are going to allow me to recover both physically and mentally. So let's pop them in there. Do you have a particular, you say you watch rubbish online. Have you got a particular favorite you always turn to?
It changes month to month. I've been enjoying or reliving my childhood days of enjoying anime. So a bit of watching Baki, Kengan Ashura, Dragon Ball Z, all the stuff that has either come out since I was younger or that I remember like watching when I was younger as well. But now I can actually, now because I don't have to worry about dad paying for the subscription to Cartoon Network, it's all online. I could just work my way through the episodes in order. And I've come to enjoy that time as well. As I've done it more and I recognize how much more energy I have for the second session, how much easier it is to come down at the end of the day, I feel less guilty doing it. And it's also something that I think is probably, it can be an issue for people that have grown up in that same mindset, that where they feel guilty for taking time out of their day for themselves, because they feel that they are obligated to always be busy and to always be doing something, even if that something isn't to serve themselves, even if it's to serve someone else. And there's nothing wrong with working for someone else. There's nothing wrong with giving your time to help someone else. But I think it's very important to give time for yourself, because you deserve it as much as anyone else does. And if that can then make you more productive in the rest of your life, then effectively overall, your overall productivity has risen anyway.
Is this a strategy that you think a lot of the elite athletes in CrossFit are using? Like now CrossFit is more of a professional sport than it's ever been. I guess 5-10 years ago, people were a professional CrossFit athlete, but they also did a lot of on face-to-face coaching as well. They might be running a gym or a box, for example. Now everyone's just sort of making sure that they're focusing just on their training. Do you think those that tend to be very successful are the ones that are optimizing their lifestyle, not just their training, but their lifestyle as well?
I think that there is a big contrast both at all the levels of the sport. I think that there are athletes that are performing at the highest level that do have the ability to just focus on the sport because they have shown that they have talent and that they have potential, and that there are now the systems, the kind of programming houses that can invest in that and give them the opportunity to live the athlete life fully. And so they don't have to do anything but train, but they are not applying all of the right lifestyle choices to really optimize their life to the sport. They're just kind of taking advantage of the fact that they don't have to work. But being on top of their sleep routine, their nutrition, work towards on their body outside of training, and strategy, the mental side of training, the mental side of competing, I think that they're probably not tapping into a lot of those things. They're leaving quite a few stones unturned. And I think that there are those people. I think that there are the people at the very top of the sport who are doing everything that they can in their power to be the best they can possibly be. And they have also proven that they are without a doubt worth the investment. So they also have the ability to focus on the sport full time. And then I think you have people underneath that they haven't made it through to that level yet. They're doing everything that they can to be the best they can be. But because they haven't got the sponsors, the backing behind them, or the programming company that they work with can't afford to invest in them that much, they are still working on the side. They're maybe still coaching multiple classes a day. And that's where Emma and I started. And that's where we were for many years. Even once we broke through and even once we went to the games, still work on the side. I still work on the side now. So I think that there's a big mix of athletes at all levels. But I think that there are more athletes than you would think that are leaving points on the table because they are not making the optimal lifestyle choices.
No, that's really interesting, because I think when people try to make a comparison between the elite and those that are kind of in the chasing pack, they immediately go to, well, what training have they done? Kind of physical qualities, et cetera, et cetera. You've got 24 hours in a day and you're training for 3 to 6 of those. It's a small bit. Like, what else are they doing? What else are they maximizing for those 3 to 6 hours, you know? So yeah, it's quite interesting to... I'm going to interrupt here because I wanted to share with you the Progress Theory newsletter. If you want the latest information and recommendations on how to optimize your physical and mental performance, then subscribe to the free Progress Theory newsletter on Substack today. Click the link in the show notes and subscribe to get the best information on human performance sent straight to your email. Now, back to the podcast. To hear that, in terms of monitoring your progress, like you talked about how, like, you know, I'm in the best competitive shape I've been ever. What kind of metrics do you track? So it doesn't necessarily have to be certain performance metrics. It could be wellness, it could be anything, but is there anything you keep an eye on throughout your training and you monitor to sort of help you know that you're heading in that right direction, or when to push? Because I know you talked about training, but not aggressively progressing so quickly. You took your time and it allowed you to develop the physical qualities to tolerate certain stresses that when the time required it, you could push it.
Yeah, so this is a tricky one, measuring your progress. Emma and I were talking about this the other day. Because of the nature of CrossFit, every competition is slightly different. And because you are training multiple things at the same time throughout the season, unless you have truly deloaded, tapered, and peaked for a competition, you can't really test anything with the confidence that the performance has not been hampered by fatigue from something else that you are training. So for example, even if you are following a weightlifting progression and it gets to the end of the progression and it finishes with a max out or a maximal complex, it's very unlikely that that's actually going to be your peak performance, knowing that you are also running, jumping, doing CrossFit workouts, doing more structured work. There's so many other things that interfere with your performance there. So testing throughout the season is very tricky. The only time you really do get a true test of your performance is when you get to competition. And so I think that a more reliable way to measure how you are progressing as an athlete than just the competition results, which again is not 100% truth, because it also depends on the events that are programmed, the performance of other people, which you can't control, and so many other factors. I think there's some other things that could be useful to test performance are being aware of your So for me, tolerance to training was a big one. Like, can I tolerate running multiple times a week, jumping multiple sessions a week, squatting and Olympic lifting multiple sessions a week? How is my tolerance to those movements doing? Has that improved? Instead of looking at max numbers that I can lift, what's the minimum numbers that I can hit on any given day, on any given weightlifting session? What's the minimum snatch weight that I can hit, or minimum complex weight that I can hit for a particular complex, even when I'm in this fatigue state? Because if those, what we call minimum weight that you can hit, if they're going up, then because you're always in a fatigued state, you are then effectively getting some measure of your strength and your progression in those movements. And then also a big thing is feeling on workouts, which is, I suppose, something that you only really get with experience as an athlete. But you know how you feel when you are doing certain workouts, certain movements. You know how it feels, how your breathing feels on sets of burpee box jump overs. You know how your cycle rate feels on a barbell, how your technique feels on a ring muscle up. And you know how it feel, how you feel when you are fit and you are able to transition between movements quickly whilst you've got the high breathing rate and the high heart rate. And when you get that feeling more often within training, and you can feel the rate of movement improving over time, then that's another measure of how much better that you've got as an athlete.
That sounds really cool. And really cool to see that you use perception as a way of determining progress, especially when something's so chaotic and deliberately chaotic, because that kind of fits in with the philosophy of CrossFit. I've always found that it's something that you're developing physical qualities to be able to take on any particular task, almost. So that's why all the events seem to be all different, and that makes it very difficult to track progress in the traditional sense.
Yeah, it's a nightmare trying to track progress objectively. After the 2020 season, so about through 2021, most of 2022, I took about a year and a half off and just lifted, because that's something I've never got to do before. I've always played sport, and the sport has usually been like very heavily conditioning biased. And so I've never got to just do lifting in isolation and work through a program focused on, like, do a bodybuilding phase, the hypertrophy phase, like do a strength phase, do like a peaking phase, and then see how much can I actually lift. And when I took out all of the conditioning, or most of the conditioning, just kept in the low intensity stuff, primarily as like recovery as well, and it was so easy to track progress, to predict the progression that you could make. If you didn't make the progression, if I didn't make a progression, it was so easy to identify, okay, here is where the volume potentially was too much, or here is where the frequency of the intensity was potentially too much. In the next phase, I'm going to change it, it works. It just became so much simpler when you only have to focus on one modality. But then when you throw in everything else, it exactly as you say, the chaos comes in. And so I think that the perception is a very important skill to develop, so that you can both understand how you are progressing in training, but also identify if you're potentially not progressing and something needs to change, because you understand how your body is supposed to feel, and both the ups and the downs. And then that also relates well to competition as well, because again, you may not have done the exact workout that you're doing in competition and training. So that perception, how does this feel? How does the pacing feel? Should I be this fatigued at this point in the workout? Is this a work rate that I can keep up for the remainder of the workout? Perception is a huge part of the sport.
When it comes to monitoring what you've done, like the training program, is everything down to a T? Like, so every session, you know exactly what you're doing. And then do you write sort of perceptual notes alongside it and say, okay, here's a particular, I don't know, couplet, heart rate was this at this point. I felt this went well. I felt this went badly. So not only you get feedback from your reflection based on like tactics of performing the particular workout, but also perception of how that session actually felt. And then if you've got that like every day, you've got a story of how all what you did in all this training and how that felt over a long period of time. And then it becomes more easy to try and determine if you have progressed or where things haven't gone as well as you'd like. Because the way you described where you took everything away and just focused on lifting, it was very easy to see exactly where, you know, you could have improved, for example, or if you didn't improve in a certain way, you know exactly where that happened. But as soon as you add everything else, it gets a bit more chaotic. But at least from your previous writing down exactly what you've done and perception of how that felt and et cetera, et cetera. Did that provide like a nice story as to like show you how well you progress in certain ways, where your training needs to go, et cetera, et cetera? So your monitoring is your training, if you know what I mean, rather than like having specific testing sessions.
Yeah, exactly. We work with Philip Bisgard of Apex Athletics, and we've been working with him for the past almost 2 years now. And that relationship does involve a lot of communication back and forth. And within that communication is both the objective stuff, so like the actual performance of the training, the numbers side of things. Like you say, heart rate can be a relevant one, depending on the workout, reps, times, all the other stuff, scoring stuff. But then the perception is another big one as well, particularly in, I suppose, the frequency of, say, bad days. So we know that some of the training is going to be good, some of the training is going to be bad, and then some of it's kind of going to be in the middle. And if we find that those days where it's getting bad are becoming more frequent, and then we're also noticing that maybe sleep is starting to be interrupted a bit, that hunger is starting to go down, the mood is starting to go down, we start spotting the signs, then it's like, okay, we're potentially needing to put in a deload here or take a step back from training because you're nearing potentially overtraining or under recovering. That's a big one in recording the feeling. And then also, like you say, recording the feeling towards different types of training over time so that you can start to see progress. And that can be feeling in terms of difficulty performing a movement if you're performing a skill. It can be in your ability to the feeling of, say, like lifting sessions when you've had to do them in a slightly fatigued state because you've already done conditioning in the morning. Is that improving all over time? Are you feeling like this is less of a daunting task for you to lift weight? Is it also easier for you to more consistently hit these numbers under fatigue? I think a big one is how easily you can warm up and get into the rhythm of a session as well. I find that as time goes, as we get further through a phase and I get more fatigued, stiffness and I suppose inflammation comes on a little quicker. And so it takes longer to warm up for sessions. You can't just walk into the gym and within 15 minutes, you're able to get onto the barbell, get onto the workout. And when that starts happening, that's another sign that, okay, maybe we're nearing the end of the phase now.
No, those are really interesting key things that sort of pick up and give you information. That's really cool, especially around warm-ups. Technically, such an easy thing to sort of track in terms of perception. I think people want something so clear-cut, but really just taking how you feel, especially if it's something as simple as how long it got you involved into the actual session, how long it took you to warm up. That's probably something which is often forgotten. Warm-ups are supposed to be there to prepare you for the session, but it also is there to provide you with information of how you are at that particular time. It's really cool to see that, you know, you take advantage of that time rather than just like it's something you just go through to get ready for a session.
I'm probably on the other side where there's nothing that I do that I just go through. Maybe even if the stuff that I should just go through, I'm still analyzing, okay, what does this mean? How is this going? Could this be better? But I do think that something that I've realize the importance of more so this season is the body's ability to adapt, which sounds obvious because that's the whole concept of training, right? You give it a stimulus and it adapts and then it gets better. You get better, you get better at what you're doing. But I think in terms of the body's ability to adapt to having to perform a task multiple times a week. So in the beginning of the season, maybe running 3 times a week or 2 times a week feels tough. It feels difficult to actually take pounding on the joints multiple days in the week. But if you start off at a sensible level and you monitor how it feels and you pay close attention to that, and that you trust that you will adapt over time, the body does adapt and you are able to introduce slightly more volume and then potentially another session, so you've increased the frequency of running a week. And it's across the board with so many things. And I found that this season, past season particularly, things that we started off with that we did a very, very small dose of in the beginning, as I've trusted the adaptation and not rushed it, almost let it come to me and then responded to it, I've been able to handle a bigger and more frequent dose of different things as the season's progressed. But then interestingly as well, when it's got to the point where I've started to push the length of a phase quite hard, So instead of setting out as like, okay, this is going to be a 4-week block, it's like, this is going to be a phase and we're just going to keep going until you start showing signs that this is enough. And then we're going to deload. So then you get to, I get to see the progression of like, okay, I'm able to handle a greater dose of this, a greater dose, a greater dose. And now I'm starting to struggle and it's not feeling good. And the warm-ups are having to take a little bit longer and the recovery between sessions is taking longer. That's a sign that, okay, I need to deload, deload, come back, and then basically pick up where we left off and continue making that progression.
Yes. So far removed from the textbook of like progress for 3 weeks, deload, progress for 3 weeks, deload, which you always see. So it just keeps progressing until like your body's telling you it needs the deload. Don't just deload early. Is there anything else that you've changed your mind on as you've gone through training and gone up the levels in CrossFit? Like, everyone's always learning, but is there anything like really stuck out to you that you're like, actually, what I was doing here back then was actually incorrect for me. This is a much better way of doing things.
Yes. Two big things. Number one is I previously thought, and for the large majority of my career, thought that I need to force myself into doing certain movements multiple times a week in order to get better at them, because the people at the top of the sport are doing these movements this often. The people at the top of the sport are squatting 3 times a week. They are running 3 times a week. They are able to do these movements so frequently, and therefore they're able to train them. They're able to get more frequent exposure to them and then get better at them. And so I need to be able to do that as well. And I also need to be able to do it in the same way that they do it as well. So I need to be able to squat my toes forwards and really engage, like to try and bias my quads. And I need to develop the ankle mobility to be able to do that. Like, I need to be able to, when I do, I don't know, dumbbell squat snatch, I need to be able to hold it in a neutral grip, because that's the best position to do it. Like this, I need to, when I snatch, I need to have my shoulders fully externally rotated, because that's how they teach it on a CrossFit level one. Like, there is a specific box of the style of training and how you perform movements, and I need to make sure that I can do that, because that's how they do it at the top of the sport. And if I'm ever going to be there, then that's the only way. And that, of course, is not the only way. Over time, understood more and more that there's not specific things that you, it's not like a blanket, you must do all of these things exactly this way. It's more a case of there are principles that you need to fulfill, and you as an individual are different to every other athlete out there in multiple ways, from your tolerance to movements, from your anatomy, from your training background, your muscle fiber makeup, your sensitivity to responding to certain types of training. There's just so many things that are individual about you as an athlete, that what's important is that you fulfill these principles and that you find a way that works for you to do that. So instead of looking at, I need to snatch with this position, it's like, what is the reason why they do that position? What's the principle behind it? Well, it's a position that provides good overhead stability. So what is the position that's right for me to get a very stable overhead position? That's the position I need to train. Why do they squat with their toes in a particular stance, a particular width? Is it because it gives them more stability? Is it because they can get deeper in their squat that way? Is it because it's easier for them to hold the dumbbell overhead that way? Find out, what is that position for you? Do you need to go wider? Do you need to have your toes turned out because that's just the structure of your hips and your ankles? If so, then do that, because then it's going to be less stress in your body, which then means you can train the movement more, which then means you can be better at the movement. And so understanding that I don't need to force myself into this structure, I need to find a way to fulfill those principles that works for me. And since I've done that, injury has become far less frequent, niggles have become less frequent, and training has just become so much more enjoyable. So that's the first one. In hindsight, when I look back at it, it seems obvious, right? Because you just look at a sport like basketball and you've got, there's a certain way that you are supposed to shoot. Well, one of the best shooters in the history of the sport that's playing right now, Steph Curry, has a shot that 30 years ago would be looked at as, that's a disgusting shot. Like, you don't shoot like that. She's the ball. And yet he's one of the best shooters in the league and the best shooters in the history of the sport. And so it's less about performing the skill the exact way. It's more about, he's learned what's the principle behind how they coach the shot and what works for me. And that's how I'm going to do it. And you see that in the individual style differences of skills in sports within the highest levels of the sport. So it makes sense that it's the same within CrossFit, where we have to deal with so many skills at the same time. Yeah, and the second one is the importance of enjoying what I'm doing, the importance of having fun with what I'm doing. And that's more of a recent understanding, because I used to be more from the side of discipline. Like, I make myself go in and I make myself do the training because I am a disciplined athlete. And I understand that if I do these things correctly, that I will get the reward at the end. And it's worked to a degree in the past, but I found that I was having to use discipline to get through training far too often. And the problem with discipline is it has a cost, right? It requires mental strength to execute discipline, to get yourself into the gym, to do the session. And that is limited. Like, everyone has a limit to how mentally, how far they can push themselves. And some more than others, but everyone has a point at which they will break and they say, I've had enough, like, I need to take a day off. Whereas fun is almost endless. You've never really heard anyone say, like, I've had too much fun, now I need to have a rest, right? It's more, if you enjoy what you're doing and it's fun that's motivating you to go into the gym and do the session, then you essentially just have like a limitless bank of will to go and train. I've been trying to find ways to enjoy training more, focus more on the positives and identify more ways in which I'm progressing to keep coming back to that fun and that enjoyment and let that fuel the training more, because it's far less mentally taxing and it's far more sustainable than using discipline to get yourself into the gym all the time. And discipline will always be necessary, because you're not going to enjoy all the sessions that you do. And if you do enjoy all the sessions you do, you're probably not training hard enough and you're probably not doing all the training that you need to be doing. But if I can use fun and enjoyment to fuel more of the training, it's going to be far more sustainable. And then when things like this happen this season, where I didn't qualify, so I didn't get my reward at the end of it, if I've had fun during the process, then that's part of the reward in itself. As opposed to if that entire process has just been fueled off of discipline, I don't get the reward at the end, then it just feels like a big negative experience.
That really reminds me of, well, I wrote a newsletter on it because there was an Instagram post by a guy called Will Rattel, and he talked about how training equals entertainment. And then it just made me reflect on a number of different podcasts that I've done with other elite athletes from different sports. And you can really get a sense of, it feels like their success was born out of the fact that, oh, they've got certain training. Oh, I can't wait for it. Like, they were active. It isn't like, oh, I've got to do this training to reach my goals. Yeah, I'm just going to do it. You know, there wasn't like this apathy towards it. It was like, no, I can't wait to train. And even if I was competitive or not, I'm going to do that training. Because they look forward to it, that just changed their perception towards that training. And that enhanced the adaptations they got from all the training over and over again. They just wanted to train. And so putting fun at the forefront of quite a few programming decisions makes complete sense, because how can I change myself so that I can't wait to do that training, if you know what I mean? Like, I am looking forward to it rather than I have to do it. I guess the differences there kind of plays into what you talked about, the discipline and the fun. If you just lean into the discipline all the time, you take away the fun, and then you don't get that, oh, I'm looking forward to that training, and then you'll get a different experience. Okay, yeah, what you're describing kind of reminded me of that.
It kind of goes with the stereotypical elite athlete is basically like a machine, and they have an endless supply of discipline, and that's what gets them through all the grueling training that they need to get through. And I think that the reality is both sides of that, right? Like, the reality is that the best athletes probably enjoy what they do a lot. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why they can do it so well, because they use that enjoyment to fuel their training. But on the other side of it is that the discipline that is required to get through the worst of it is probably far more than people would imagine, because it's one thing to, like, when you first start the sport, most people start sport because they enjoy it, right? They enjoy it, it's fun, and then you do it more and more, and over time it becomes less of a hobby, and eventually at some point it becomes a job, and at some point it becomes less enjoyable as well. And now it turns from I get to do this, and it turns towards I have to do this. And so I think you get both sides of the stereotype, like the discipline that is far more severe and far more like and far tougher than people probably imagine. And then you also get the side of it which is actually far more enjoyable, which is the reason why you started in the first place. And that I think the elite athletes, I believe, are the ones that use that the best.
Before we started recording, we started talking about elite athletes and kind of obsessive qualities towards training. As soon as you say obsessive qualities, you think negatively, you think pure discipline, et cetera, et cetera. I saw a clip regarding Maradona the other day and how he would just, even if he wasn't playing, like in the changing rooms, he would then roll up a pair of socks and then just do keepy uppies with the pair of socks. And because he's done that over so many years, he was just so good. And he just had this obsession towards football that he would make fun out of any situation and brought football into it, which then led to more practice, which then led to him being exceptional. And I wonder if elite athletes at the CrossFit level in CrossFit are quite similar, like they are deliberately obsessive, so they have the discipline there, but they are obsessive to try and create fun out of what they love doing, which makes work not feel like work, which as an elite athlete, I guess CrossFit training is your work.
Any elite athlete in any sport is obsessed with what they're doing. And I think that that is a good thing. I think that there's probably an unnecessary negative connotation with the word obsessed or to be obsessive, but I don't think that being obsessed is a bad thing. Like, we are on this earth for a finite period of time. We're not going to be able to do what we are doing at any point in our lives forever. So why not be obsessed with what you are doing? Why not go all the way in and see what you can make of yourself doing this? Like, what's the best you could possibly be if you put everything into what you were doing? And then once you're finished with it, you can be satisfied with where you finish, knowing that you've done the best you can do, and then move on to something else. I think that that's a far better approach than to be, oh, I don't want to be obsessed, I don't want to take it too seriously, and then get to the end of it and not really know, could I have done better? If I put more effort in, if I put more time in, if I paid attention to all the details, what could I have actually done? And that feeling of like not knowing would be far worse than being completely obsessed in even failing to reach the goals that you had, but then knowing like, well, that's clearly what I'm capable of. That's the end of that, and then move on to something else. In my opinion, I think that that's probably the behavior that the elite athletes have. And I think that's probably the best way to go about it, to like to fully commit to it and then find out what you can achieve at the end.
So if you had to give advice to, say, a sub-elite CrossFit athlete that wants to make it to that elite level, what advice would you give them? And that advice could come from training, lifestyle, mindset, whatever it might be. What advice would you give them?
The first thing I would say is that don't pay too much attention to social media. That it can be very, very misleading, that it makes you think that everybody just has good days all the time. And the reality is very different to that. You shouldn't be trying to have good days all the time, because the bad days are part of the journey, and how you deal with those bad days is as much a determinant of your success as how many good days you have. So I think one of the things would be, especially because social media is so big now, compared to when I started the sport and when I was playing other sports when I was younger, that I think it does have a big impact on how people perceive their journey to the elite levels is going to be. So I think, say, just ignore social media, or at least the impression that it gives of the journey. Pay attention to the information aspect of it. So like when you're watching people's techniques, when you're getting information on training and strategy of competition, things like that, it's a great source of information. But yeah, maybe not so much on the lifestyle side, the journey side of things. And then I think the other thing would be to recognize that everyone's journey to where they end up at the end of their sport is very different. And especially now, when you can get athletes that show a tiny bit of potential and they're just fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time, and they get a huge amount of backing, and now they can train all they want, but they haven't really done anything yet. All the way to the other end of the spectrum, where you've got athletes who are at the highest end of the sport and still working a job on the side. So I think just keeping an open mind, being curious about what you are doing so that you are leaving yourself available to pick up information from different sources, whether it be how to execute a skill, to how to program, or how to like, or programming different programming structures for CrossFit. I think keeping an open mind and staying curious, but also being aware that your journey is going to be potentially very different from the people that you're following, or the people that you train, or the people that you've seen get to top levels, because then I think that's going to stop you from running into these situations where you get down because you haven't maybe made it yet, or you've fallen short of your goal, which is an easy thing to do, because you don't really see the elite athletes in the sport, the best in the sport. They're only known as the best once they've made it, like once they've won an event at semifinals, once they've qualified for the CrossFit Games. Now they're an elite athlete, and it's like they've just popped up out of nowhere. They've just been like all this time, they've just been sat on the couch at home watching CrossFit Games on YouTube, and then all of a sudden, bang, now they're at the CrossFit Games. And people don't realize that it's like it's years and years that most of these people have been working for. And then that's at some point through like the consistent hard work and attention to detail, they eventually like break through, and now they're there, and now they get the exposure, now they get the attention, and now they appear on your Instagram. But what they're doing now may not be the same as what they were doing for all those years when they were training to make it through. It's very easy to just look at that, like just look at the stars now and think like, wow, that's why I'm going to be like, I'm just going to pop up out of nowhere. But the reality is they've probably been in the game for years, and it's just taken a while to get through.
Now, that's absolutely awesome advice. I think, especially with social media, everyone is really focused on trying to find the answer, but really, like you kind of describe, get a load of information and then you provide the answer for yourself. You know, you're not copy and pasting, you're finding your own way there. And whether that would be in terms of your journey to the elite level or your strategy to perform particular movements like you described earlier, like be open that your process and what you're doing might look completely different to what you see on social media. I remember when all there was just Facebook, and it was just people saying random stuff as their Facebook status. We should, and it's like pictures of your friends, bring that back. Now everyone's a brand, yeah, aren't they? So yeah. That's what you see on social media, everyone showing their best bit, whereas I'm sure back in the day everyone showed their worst bits.
Yeah, that was even more entertaining, wasn't it? It was that MSN Messenger, MySpace. Yeah, yeah, I remember.
MSN Messenger.
Good old days, simple life.
Yeah, bring it back. What is old is new. Bring back Facebook and MSN Messenger. Yeah, of course.
Nah, it's brilliant, Instagram. The good thing about it is the bad thing about it, right? Like everyone has a voice and none of it is vetted. Like anyone can express their opinion and that opinion can then be conveyed and perceived as fact or opinion. And so it requires a quite a big filter to be able to identify, like, is this truth or is this fake news, as they say. My dad actually got Instagram not long ago, like less than a year ago, and he's the typical like old school Nigerian dad who was not interested in social media or anything at all. And then I think my mum was already on it, and he wanted to know. I would send him stuff, like I'd message him pictures of Emma and I at competition every now and then and keep him up to date and what's going on. And I said to him, just get Instagram and then you'll be able to see everything. And he didn't want to get it because he's like, I don't want to post anything. I just explained to him, you don't have to post anything. You can even have a private profile. But if you've got one and you can follow us, you can see what's going on. I don't have to send you messages all the time. And he got it. And since he's got it, he's been obsessed with it because he realizes that he can just go on there and just scroll through like entertaining post after entertaining post. But every now and then he sends me something and he says like, is this true? Because when he's the only other like information that he gets is from the newspaper and the news, and there it's a little bit, well, significantly more, say, like factual than what you're going to get on Instagram. So, but he hasn't yet, because he's not grown up with the social media, he hasn't developed that like filter to look at something and know, like, no, this is fake. And it's interesting getting that from him, because you start to realize how easy it would be to be influenced by these things if you didn't have that filter, if you actually thought that this is how life is. And so that's why I think that the curiosity thing is good, because you can go through Instagram and you can see from like the deeper stuff to like just more shallow stuff, like how people are executing techniques, and you can pay attention to that and try it out. and know that this might not be perfect, but it could work for me. And it could, if it doesn't work for me, it can still inspire a different way of doing something that then contributes to my development. And so I think that it's still, it's a great tool. You just have to, like anything, you need to learn how to use it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I completely agree. I still think that having that filter is something that continuously develops. So for example, you probably only follow people that you want to follow because you feel like the information they provide is relevant and is useful to yourself.
Right.
But quite often, I think these social media apps want to push more to everyone because they want, you know, more engagement with a wider audience, because that means wider eyes on things. They can get more ad revenue with that. But as that sort of changes, I feel like my filter has to adapt and change as well, because you're getting so many different forms of information at times, even though, like, I think I'm quite selective with the people who I want, because I believe I learn from them or I'm entertained by them. I don't know if it's true for you as well, but I feel like my filter goes through fluctuations and it's a skill.
Yeah, it definitely is a skill. And it does take some honing and some time on Instagram to develop it well. Something I find that is especially dangerous is the, I don't know if the right word is confirmation bias, but like when you start researching a certain thing, and you start researching maybe like a particular view of something, and Instagram must recognize that like this post is attached to these hashtags, these tags. And so it pushes you more information of what you were looking at. So then you start to get this feeling of like, yeah, this really is the truth. This is the fact, because everyone's posted about it. So it must be right. And then all of a sudden you'll come across something that's completely different. And then you'll start to question, oh, maybe that isn't correct. And that process, I think because of social media, it gets sped up compared to when it was more a case of like looking at research yourself and maybe talking to colleagues. It was a lot more slower and methodical, whereas now it could just be back and forth week to week. But it's not a bad thing, is it, to question whether you have the right approach to something? But it does take, you have to keep quite an open mind.
I think you're 100% right. I think it's the speed of how things have changed and adapting to that. Because you're always curious and you have a level of creativity, but when you're getting bombarded with so much information and that information's getting layered because of an algorithm that's forcing you down a certain path, for example, it's quite hard to, the speed of that is quite hard to deal with. I think you're certainly right there.
Mm.
David, that was absolutely class. What are your social media handles so that anyone listening can give you a follow and might want to look into what you're doing at the moment?
It's less handles and just handle, just the one. Instagram is enough for me.
Smart.
I'm unfortunately too old to be able to handle the TikToks and the rest of them, but the Snapchats, it's just at Shorunke, Shorunke is me on Instagram. And if you want to keep up to date with my training, my season, who I'm working with, just what's going on, that's where you can do that.
No, brilliant. And I recommend everyone give David a follow, because I think the information that you put, even though your stuff is more so around what you're doing, your training, I think especially around your stories, there's quite a lot of, you know, detailed, valuable information there for anyone that wants to get towards the elite level of CrossFit. So anyone listening, definitely check that out. But David, I think we're going to have a round two at some point if you're keen for it in a second podcast, because that was great. And I've actually still got loads of questions, but I know we've gone over an hour now. So if you're keen, round two would be great.
Oh man, if anyone is interested to listen to more of my rambling, I'd be more than happy to come on again and ramble more.
Yeah, perfect. Cheers, mate. Before we wrap up, I want to give a shout out and my thanks to my production partner, Cult Media. If you are thinking of launching a podcast or want to grow your audience, head to www.cult.media, that's cult with a K, to get started today.